They put the towel back in place and lowered me towards the water. Chapter 37. Kamali had walked through the rear of the temple, passed between the remains of thick masonry walls, and entered an underground space called the spoliarium, the area where dead gladiators were stripped of their weapons and the bodies disposed of. She wondered what was happening above. Surely it couldn't be long before she heard her brother calling out to tell her that it was over and they could leave. What a waste, she thought. Spitz was a brilliant investigator, certainly the best she had ever known. The idea about the mirrors in the French house alone was evidence of that. He would have got away with the whole subterfuge of his identity, too, except for driving across the border in a rent-a-car that could be traced to him. Didn't they have cameras with license tag recognition in America? They probably invented them. Strange that such a clever man would make a mistake like that. Of course, she would never have known who he really was, except for the call from the man at MIT. And what about those guys? One phone call and then nothing. No follow-up questions, no approaches to check on Spitz's movements or details. By using her drug world contacts, she had found out more about him with one break-in than Turkish intelligence had achieved with all their resources. In fact, it didn't seem as if they were very interested in Spitz at all. A terrible thought struck her. What if the American hadn't made a mistake by driving across the border? Say the deputy director of MIT was in their employ, or somebody had rerouted her call and she hadn't been speaking to him at all. What if all the clues she had followed had been planted? Imagine if it was a sting. It would mean that she had been supposed to show the information to her brother and get him to emerge from the shadows. "In the name of God," she said, and started to run. She passed the vaults where the gladiator's weapons and armor had once been stored and raced up a long ramp towards the Porta Libitinensis, the gate of death, through which the bodies of the dead entertainers were removed. She had almost reached its ruined arch, the whole arena spread out in front of her, when her cell phone, no longer in the dead spot, started to ring. She pulled it out and saw that she had at least a dozen missed calls. All, like the current one, were from her nanny. She answered, desperately frightened, speaking in Turkish. "What is it?" But it wasn't her nanny's voice that replied. It was an American man speaking English.
"Leyla Kamali," he said.
Terrified, she yelled,
"Who are you?"
But he didn't answer, using instead the exact words the two of us had planned in my hotel room.
"I have sent you a video file.
Look at it." In her confusion and fear, she didn't seem to hear, demanding again to know who he was.
"If you want to save your nephew, look at the video,"
Ben demanded.
"It is shot in real time. It's happening now."
Her nephew, Kamali thought. They know everything. Hands shaking, almost in tears, she found the video file and opened it. She watched it and almost collapsed, screaming into the phone,
"No, please, oh no!"
Chapter 38. I was drowning again. This time in pain as well as in water. I was fighting for my life, fluid cascading over my face and my shattered foot, generating surge after surge of agony. It was fast becoming the only consciousness I knew. My head was tilted back, my throat open, water flowing down and triggering endless spasms of gagging. My chest was heaving, my lungs screaming, and my body collapsing. Terror had chased down every rational thought and had me cornered. I had tried counting again, but had lost it at 57 seconds. That seemed like a lifetime ago. Behind the blindfold, I had traveled beyond the last star. I had seen the void at the end of the universe, a darkness without form or shape or end. I knew that they had damaged me in a place far beyond pain, scarred me in my soul. A wisp of memory found me in my corner. Whisper had said something. He had said if it ever got too much for me, I should finish it. Roll to my rifle and go to my God like a soldier. But that was the final cruelty of it. Because the torturers controlled the amount of water, I couldn't even open my throat, flood my lungs, and drown myself quickly. Even the last dignity, the one of taking my own life, was unattainable. I was forced to go on, to suffer, to stand at the door to nowhere but never be able to step through it. The Saracen checked his watch. The American had already endured for 125 seconds, longer than any man he had known, far longer than he had expected, approaching the mark set by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, a great warrior, a follower of the one true God, and a courageous student of the Holy Quran. Surely he must be ready to talk now. He motioned the two Albanians. I felt water stream from my hair and the filthy towel rip free of my face as they pulled me out. I was shaking, my body completely out of control and my mind not far behind. The terror was physical. Every fear in my life made manifest. I couldn't speak, but as I returned from the abyss, the pain in my foot came back with a wild ferocity, and I felt myself plunging into a welcome unconsciousness. The Saracen hit me hard on my broken cheek, and the surge of adrenaline stopped me. He forced open my eyelids and looked into my pupils, seeing how much life was present, while his other hand probed my neck until he found an artery, checking to see if my heartbeat was irregular and threatening to fail. He stepped back and looked at me, gasping for air, trying to control my tremors, forcing aside the pain in my foot.
"Who are you?"
he said so softly, I was probably the only one who could hear it. I saw the concern and confusion on his face, and it gave me strength. In our epic battle of wills, I was dying, but I was winning.
"The name,"
he said. I shook my head weakly.
"Give him to me,"
Nicolaides said, exploding with impatience.
"No," responded the Saracen. "You'll end up killing him, and we'll know nothing. We've got hours if we need them."
"Until somebody sails past to look at the ruins and gets curious," Nicolaides said.
"Go and move the boat, then," the Saracen replied. "Put it behind the rocks so nobody can see."
Nicolaides hesitated, not accustomed to being ordered around.
"Go," the Saracen said. "We're just wasting more time."
The bull glared and gave in, turning to the two Albanians, ordering them to help him. The men vanished down the main passageway, and the Saracen looked down at me slumped against the trough, still bound to the board, my wrists swollen and twisted out of shape, the steel cuffs cutting into the flesh, and my fingers as white as the marble from the lack of blood. He poked my shattered foot with the toe of his shoe and watched me wince. He did it again, harder, and despite myself, I cried out.
"It's only going to get worse," he promised quietly.
He lifted back his shoe to kick the raw flesh, but he never got the chance. From out of the darkness of the side passage, we heard a voice. She was yelling in Arabic, frantically. Chapter 39. From where I was lying, I had an unobstructed view as Kamali ran into the light, fear written all over her face, the cell phone clutched tight, her brother racing to meet her. For a moment, I wondered what had happened. In my mind, the plan was shattered, and I was finding it difficult to process even the most rudimentary information. I couldn't conceive that Bradley was alive. I didn't remember that one phone call could still save both myself and the mission. I watched in confusion, trying not to surrender to the pain in my foot and wrists, as Kamali reached her brother and thrust the phone at him. He spoke in Arabic, but it was clear that he was demanding to know what was wrong. Gasping for breath, Kamali just pointed at the phone. The Saracen looked at the screen. His beloved son stared back, innocent and uncomprehending. Tears streaked the little guy's face, but because he was being filmed, he was trying his best to smile. He had a hangman's noose around his neck. The Saracen stared at the still frame, his entire universe trembling, everything he thought he knew and understood shaken to its foundations. He looked at me, murderous and volatile. Somebody was threatening his child. He would... He flew towards me, his eyes incandescent with anger, and in my wounded mind a gear finally meshed. It was the phone call I had tried so hard to count down to, the one which I had desperately wanted to hear. It was the only explanation for the woman's distress and the Saracen's anger. "Bradley," had come through. I tried to sit a little straighter, but I was still strapped to the board. Despite a wave of pain, I managed to remember what I had rehearsed in my hotel room when my mind and body were whole, and terror was something which only other men knew. I had guessed that the moment of greatest danger would be when the Saracen realized it was a sting and that his child's life was in the balance. He might lash out in fury and kill whoever was close at hand. I dug down and recalled what I had to say.
"Be sensible, and you can save your son," I said, half-faltering.
"How do you know it's my son?"
he yelled. "You can save him if you want," I repeated, not bothering to explain.
His sister had recovered enough to start screaming at her brother, half in Arabic, half in English, all in anguish, telling him not to waste time, to ask me what he had to do to save the child. The Saracen kept staring at me, unsure whether to surrender to logic or anger.
"Look at the picture," Kamali yelled. "Look at your son."
She pushed the phone closer to his face, and he looked again at the child's image. He turned to me.
"What is happening? Tell me," he demanded.
"Speak to the man on the phone," I replied.
The Saracen put the phone to his mouth and spoke in English, venomous.
"Who are you?"
he said, trying to assert control. I knew Bradley would ignore it. Just as we had planned, he would tell the Saracen to watch a video clip he was about to send. The first shot would be of a clock or watch to prove that it wasn't faked, that we hadn't staged it, that it was happening as we spoke. The Saracen played the clip. He saw the clock, and then he seemed to stagger. His sister, watching too, clung to him, crying out in a mix of Arabic and Turkish. The clip showed one end of the rope attached to the brass bolt that had once supported the kitchen light. The other end was the noose around the little guy's neck. He was standing on the shoulders of the obese and sweat-drenched nanny. When her knees gave out, she would fall, and the boy would hang. It was a horrific scene, and it was no wonder that Bradley had objected so vehemently to it. But I needed something so shocking that the Saracen would have no time to act or plan. In truth, I couldn't take all the credit, if that was the word, for devising it. I had read about it years ago. During the Second World War, Japanese troops had made captured European fathers support their kids in exactly the same fashion. They had then forced the children's mothers to watch until their husbands stumbled and fell. Of course, to the Japanese, it was sport. The Saracen lowered the phone and looked at me in hatred. While he stood rooted to the ground, Kamali flew at me, about to rip and tear at my injured face. Her brother hauled her back. He was trying to think, his eyes darting around the walls of the ruins. It was a better indication of the prison in which he found himself than the bars of any cage. My mind was starting to function, and I knew I had to keep the pressure on, to deny him any chance of disrupting the script I had written.
"I and my people won't tolerate any delay," I said. "Listen to the phone again."
Robotic. In shock, the Saracen lifted the phone and heard a woman at the other end sobbing, hysterical, speaking to him in Turkish. It disoriented him. It was a language he didn't understand, and he handed it to his sister. She started to translate into Arabic, but I stopped her.
"In English," I demanded.
She told her brother it was the nanny.
"She's pleading," she said. "She can barely stand. She says, if we can't save her, at least save the child."
She grabbed the Saracen's shirt, losing control.
"What in God's name have you done? What have you led us into?"
He threw her hand off, and she stumbled backwards, breathing hard, staring at him in fury.
"We estimated that the nanny would probably be able to stand for another 6 minutes," I said. "Of course, we could be wrong. It might be less."
I was making it up, but in the desperate circumstances, nobody challenged it. The Saracen looked at the image on the phone and then at me. I knew that he was reeling, uncertain what to do.
"You're his father," I said quietly. "Your son is your responsibility. Save him."
I had learned long ago in Geneva that love wasn't weak. Love was strong. Now I had gambled everything on the power of it. The Saracen said nothing, immobilized, unable to think or decide, caught between his grand plan for the future and his son's life. I had to force him, and I reached down into my fragmented mind and remembered what I had to say. "What value is a promise?" I said, "especially one to a dying wife. But go ahead if you want to. Break a promise made before Allah." He stared at me, breathing in shallow gulps, scared.
"How do you know that? Who told you about Gaza?"
I made no reply, and he turned away from the two of us. He was lost in darkness, trying to find a way out of the prison, thinking, I was certain, about holding his dying wife, how his son was his last tangible link to her, and the sacred promise he had made to her and to God to protect him. I saw his shoulders slump, and then his voice broke with a sudden anguish.
"What do you want?" he said, turning towards me. "Tell me what to do."
Kamali, sobbing in relief, threw her arms around him.
"I have to let the man on the phone know that I'm alive and safe," I said. "Untie me."
The Saracen hesitated. Once he released me, he knew that there was no going back, but he didn't get any more time to think about it. Kamali stepped forward, released the leather straps that bound me to the board, took a key out of her pocket, and unlocked the cuffs. They fell to the ground, and I almost passed out from the flood of pain as the circulation started to return to my swollen hands. I managed to grab the side of the trough and haul myself upright. As soon as I touched my battered foot to the ground, the explosion of crushed nerves almost sent me back into the mud, but somehow I stayed on my feet and put my hand out for the phone. The Saracen gave it to me, but I didn't raise it to my face. Instead, I reached my hand out to the two of them.
"Weapons," I said.
They both handed over a pistol. The cop's was a standard Beretta 9mm, but the Saracen's, probably provided by Nicolaides, was a SIG 1911 stainless, made in Switzerland, as good a weapon as you could ever buy over the counter. I shoved the Beretta in my pocket and kept the SIG held loosely in my swollen fingers. Given the state of my hands, I wasn't sure if I could even fire it. I shifted the weight on my damaged foot, fought back a wave of nausea, and raised the phone to my mouth.
"Ben,"
I said, my voice rasping and broken, probably barely recognizable to him.
"Is that you?"
he asked. The sound of the cop's voice, something I thought I would never hear again, almost overwhelmed me. I slumped for a moment, and realized how they had nearly destroyed me.
"Sort of," I said after a moment. "I'm gonna open the mic, Ben,"
I continued, trying to remember the details I had so meticulously planned.
"You'll hear whatever is going on. If something happens to me, shoot the nanny, okay?"
I saw the information register with the Saracen and Kamali, and I lowered the phone. Despite the freshly dug craters in my mind, I knew I had to move fast. I turned to the woman.
"Go down the tunnel. Stay hidden and watch the beach. When you see the others, head back fast and warn me. Remember, get smart and sign them up to attack me, and the man in Bodrum will hear. You know what he'll do."
She nodded and ran, desperate to make it work, desperate to save the boy. In her anxiety and fear, I doubted she even realized she had become my closest ally. I turned and looked at the Saracen. I knew that no matter how much agony I had gone through, the really difficult part lay ahead. I had to get him to tell me the truth, and not defeat me with lies and disinformation.
"My name is Scott Murdoch," I said, through the pain of my injuries. "I am an American intelligence agent. I am going to ask you some questions."
Chapter 40. I had lain awake in my hotel for hours the previous night, thinking about how I would interrogate Zachariah al-Nusayri if I ever got the chance. I decided my only hope was to ask a relentless wave of questions, never giving him the opportunity to guess which ones I knew the answer to and which ones I didn't. I had to mix knowledge and ignorance so effectively that he would be loath to risk any lie at all, and I had to do it so fast that he wouldn't have time to think and weave.
I knew it would have been difficult a few hours ago, but wounded in body and mind, I had no idea if I could manage it now. One mistake. One successful deception, and it would have all been for nothing.
If you lie, give me one incorrect answer, I told him. I will shoot you and turn the phone off. As you know, the man in Bodrum has his instructions concerning your son. Clear?
I didn't wait for an answer.
Who recruited Patros Nikolaidis? I said, worried that my damaged throat would fail me.
Straight off, the question wrong-footed him. Nobody had mentioned the old bull's name, and I could see the Saracen was wondering how the hell I knew it. Already he was on the defensive.
My sister,
he replied, trying to show he wasn't shaken.
When she was 12, she won an essay competition. What for? English. English comprehension.
Who the hell did they speak to, he must have been thinking. Who would know details like that? His mother?
What hospital treated the shrapnel in your spine? Gaza Infirmary.
I was flying all over the world, leaping across decades.
Did your sister ever go scuba diving?
My father taught her, when she was young.
It was probably correct. Their father had worked at the Red Sea Marine Biology Department.
How many Hind helicopter gunships did you bring down?
I checked the phone's microphone, desperately hoping Bradley was taking notes. In my state, I wasn't sure I could remember the answers. The Saracen was shocked. Now we were in Afghanistan.
Three, some say four, he replied.
I could see it in his face.
Who is this man?
After the war with the Soviets, where did you buy your death certificate?
In Quetta, Pakistan.
Who from?
How do I know? It was in the bazaar.
Who provided you with a new identity?
I looked straight at him.
Abdul Muhammad Khan.
His reply was one micron softer than the others, and I figured it was a betrayal.
Good. Keep your voice up, I said. The address of your childhood home in Jeddah.
You know, you've seen a photo of it.
I've been there, I took that photo, I replied. Where were you stationed when you fought in Afghanistan?
The Hindu Kush, a village called...
I talked over him, letting him think I already knew the answer, keeping the pace relentless.
What nationality was your new identity?
Lebanese.
I had got my first one. I had a nationality, and with that, I knew we could start to trace him if we had to. The walls were closing in. In the house in Bodrum, Bradley was holding the phone tight to his ear, trying to hear everything, papers scattered on the bench in front of him, scrawling notes furiously because of the speed I was going. He said later that he was almost certain, to judge by my voice, that I was dying on my feet. Chapter 41. I felt like it too. I scooped a handful of water out of the trough and threw it on my face. Anything to keep going. Anything to lessen the pain and cool what I feared was a blossoming fever.
Who is Saeed bin Abdullah bin Mabruk al-Bishi?
I demanded.
State executioner,
the Saracen replied.
Country? Saudi Arabia. How do you know him?
He paused, and I realized that the wound was still raw even after so many years.
He killed my father.
Faster,
I warned him.
What was your date of birth?
He had barely begun before I hit him with the next one.
What blood group are you?
He only got half the answer out when I swerved again. I had to keep him reeling.
What is the common name for Amphipryon Ocellaris?
Clownfish.
Where did you receive your medical degree?
Beirut University. Who paid? Scholarship. The U.S. State Department.
I didn't react, but yeah, it figured.
What mosque did you attend as a youth in Bahrain?
I couldn't recall the name, but the Saracen's answer sounded right.
With which radical group was it affiliated?
The Muslim Brotherhood.
Name the last hospital you worked at.
El Mina District.
That was the second one. Hospitals had employment records, and they would show the name he had been using since he had first acquired the Lebanese passport.
Who was the medical director? What year did you start? Which month?
The Saracen had no choice but to answer. The speed was unsparing, but it was costing me dearly. My small reserves of energy were rapidly depleting, and I was certain now that an ache at the back of my head was a symptom of fever. I figured an infection from the open wounds was starting to pour through my body.
Go faster, I told myself. Faster.
The name of the boy's mother?
Amina.
Ibadi?
Yes.
he replied, staggered at my knowledge.
How many other names did she use?
Four.
Tell me the relationship between Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade and your son's orphanage.
They funded it.
How was your wife killed? A Zionist rocket.
God, the bitterness in his voice.
What was the name of Nikolaidi's son who died in Santorini?
What?
He countered, confused and desperate.
We're back at the Greeks?
He had no idea where we were going next, and it gave me strength. I realized every detail of my epic journey counted. I was using every thread. For once, I was picking up every stitch. Nothing had been wasted. Nothing.
The name of the son,
I demanded. He tried to recall, maybe not even sure he had ever been told it.
I can't.
He was panicking.
Christopher,
he said, but he wasn't sure.
No.
Christos,
I said, and gave him a pass.
Where were you the day before you came to Bodrum?
Germany.
I figured it was true. It had to be somewhere close.
How long were you there?
2 months.
The name of the street of the mosque you attended?
Wilhelmstrasse.
Which town?
Karlsruhe.
Name the three foreigners you killed in the Hindu Kush.
I don't remember.
First names, what did they call each other?
Jenica.
I didn't wait. I couldn't recall them either.
Did you use a web message board to communicate with your sister?
Yes.
Who was Clownfish?
My nickname.
What illness did your son have when you were in the Hindu Kush?
He stared at me. How the hell did I know his son had been ill?
In the flu.
In desperation, he was trying a lie, testing me. But I looked straight at him, and he thought better of it.
Meningococcal meningitis.
Too slow, and don't try that again. What is the name of the largest hotel in Karlsruhe?
I hadn't heard of the town, and I needed another fact to make sure we didn't focus on the wrong place. I felt the fever getting worse.
Deutschkönig,
he said.
Did you work there?
At the hotel?
In Karlsruhe?
Yes.
Where?
Chiron.
It meant nothing to me, and I wasn't even sure I had heard it correctly.
Full name. It's American. That is its full name.
The Saracen was sweating, probably trying to imagine the sign at the front of the building, but he blinked. I raised the phone to speak to Ben, as if I were threatening the boy. He got it.
Chiron, Pharmafabrik, GmbH. Name of the mosque you attended as a child.
I didn't care. I saw the Saracen relax, just a tiny easing of the muscles around his jaw, and I knew that Karlsruhe and its chemical factory was the hottest of the hot zones.
Your address when you were working in Elmina?
The Saracen could barely keep up, but he gave a street name and a number. He hadn't finished before I hit him again.
Name three people I can verify it with.
He gave them, but I didn't care about Elmina either, even though I guessed that was where he had synthesized the virus.
What job did you have at Chiron?
I was back where I wanted to be, in the hot zone. I could tell from his face he didn't share my enthusiasm.
Shipping clerk.
Name of supervisor?
Serdar.
What shift?
Graveyard.
What is Chiron's primary business?
Pharma. Drugs.
What sort of drugs?
Vaccines.
I gambled. Probably the biggest gamble of my life. But a doctor didn't get a job on the night shift in a drug company's shipping department for nothing.
When did the virus leak Karlsruhe?
He paused fractionally, and I put the phone to my mouth, ready to pull the pin. He stared at me for a moment longer.
Yesterday,
he said quietly. I felt granite towers of mystery collapse, and a blitz of relief so intense that for a moment I forgot the pain. I knew it now. In the last 24 hours, a vaccine contaminated with the smallpox virus had left a company in Germany called Chiron Chemicals. It was already in America, or close enough, and my urgent thought was, how big? What was the scale of the attack?
How many doses?
I said.
100.
It was the tiny inflection, the dropping away of the sound at the end, as if you were trying to shrug it off, that warned me. I still had the phone at my mouth. The SIG was in my other hand, and I pointed the barrel straight at his face.
I'll only do this once. I'm going to ask you again, how many?
He seemed to slump.
10,000,
he said. It took acres of self-control not to react.
10,000.
The number had to be true. It was too extraordinary to be a lie, and in that moment I put the last piece of the puzzle together.
Given the scale of the attack and the time of year, the virus could only have been hidden in one place. I was certain I knew where it was and what he had planned. For the first time in what seemed like half a lifetime, I had no more questions. I leaned against the trough. I was in pain, beyond exhaustion, and with the fever steadily colonizing my body, sweat was starting to run down my cheeks. I looked up and saw Al-Nusseri staring at me. He knew why the interrogation had stopped. I had found everything I needed, and all of his years of work, the very thing which had given his life weight and meaning, was in ruins. He was about to say something, probably to curse me in the name of his god, but he didn't get the chance. We saw Kamali running hard towards us.
"They're coming,"
she called, stumbling to a stop. "Together?" I asked, rapidly shaking off the exhaustion. "Anyone straggling?"
"No, together."
It gave me a chance. If they were strung out, the man at the back would be warned by the gunfire, and I didn't like my odds against some jerk with a machine pistol. Surprise, and hitting them in a group, was the best weapon. I heard Bradley yelling on the phone, worried that something had happened, wondering why the hell the questioning had stopped. I lifted it fast.
"Problem," I said. "Hold tight, 3 minutes."
I stuffed the phone into my pocket and started flexing my swollen fingers, trying to see if I could fire the SIG. One thing was certain. Because of my damaged foot, I wouldn't be able to stand or even crouch. What I needed was help. Chapter 42. The Beretta flew through the air. I had taken it out of my pocket and tossed it quickly to Kamali. She caught it and looked at me, surprised.
"Anything happens to me," I said, "the man in Bodrum won't accept any excuses. He'll shoot the nanny. So you'd better make sure I live. Got it?"
She was about to nod, but her brother interrupted.
"This is no work for her. She's a woman. Give me the gun."
I stared at him with incredulity, but then I checked myself. Given his background and beliefs, I should have anticipated it.
"No," I said. "Do you know that I was a moosh?" he continued arguing. "I've killed before, and I'm a better shot. Give it to me."
"No," I said emphatically. "I don't trust you. And anyway, you're the decoy."
He reacted. "The decoy?" I had no time to explain, and I turned back to Kamali.
"Ever killed anyone?"
"Never."
She didn't look as if she liked the idea much.
"Just remember, then, you're not shooting a man, you're saving your nephew."
I told her to move fast to an area of fallen stone that would give her cover and a clear view of the three men.
"Your target is the old guy," I said. "He'll be slower, and he's only got a handgun. I'll try and nail the two with the machine pistols. I'll be sitting. The decoy will be standing, acting like he's interrogating me. The moment you see me roll onto my shoulder, open fire. Aim at Nikolaidis' chest. When he goes down, keep shooting, okay? Noise always helps."
I grabbed the polished steel lid of the old freezer box and positioned it against a fallen column. I lowered myself to the ground and leaned against the water trough, my back half turned to the approaching enemy. When they saw me, slumped and facing away from them, they wouldn't suspect anything was wrong. Nor would they see the SIG in my lap. The polished steel of the freezer lid wasn't much of a mirror, but it would work. It would give me a clear view of the battlefield and the exact position of the three hostiles as they approached. I heard Kamali whisper,
"They're coming."
I slid the safety off the SIG, hoped that in her anxiety the cop had remembered to do the same, and waited with the Saracen standing over me. I was breathing hard. A broken man whose eyes happened to be focused unwaveringly on the polished steel lid of the freezer. I saw the reflection of Nikolaidis and the other two as they entered, and I forced myself to wait for the moment snipers called maximum kill. 4 seconds. 3. The sun shifted slightly on its axis, and a shaft of direct light pierced the shattered roof. It hit the cool box top, and the sharp glint called the three men's attention straight to it. Nikolaidis was no fool. He realized that the steel lid had been moved. He squinted hard and saw me watching them. He screamed a warning to the Albanians, hurled himself aside, and drew his pistol. I dropped my shoulder and started rolling into a firing position. Kamali opened up with the Beretta, but wasn't good enough to hit anything, let alone the sprinting bull. I rolled over and over through the mud and dirt, crying out as the pain from my battered foot and injured chest shot through me, drawing aim on Muscle Man. He was wheeling with his machine pistol, about to blast the crap out of the water trough and anything nearby, including me. The Saracen, unarmed, was in midair, attempting to scramble to safety behind the rubble. Upside down, on my back, I had my finger on the trigger, but it was swollen so badly I could barely feel a thing. In desperation, I fired a burst of three at Muscle Man, working hard to spread them. Normally, my first shot would have at least hit the target, but this was anything but normal, and the first two missed completely. The third got him in the groin. Nowhere near deadly, but the range was so close it hurled him backwards. He dropped the scorpion and clutched at what was left of his genitals. Kamali, spraying bullets as she tracked with the fast-moving Nikolaides, didn't have a clue about what else was happening on the field. She missed the old bull by a mile, but shot the helper through the throat. He collapsed immediately. She kept firing, chasing Nikolaides even though he was fast approaching the water trough. Bullets splattered in the mud all around me. Jesus! I would have yelled a warning, but nobody would have heard it over the screams of Muscle Man trying to stem the blood pouring from his crotch. I tried to roll to safety, but got slammed backwards. A rush of pain erupted in the soft flesh of my shoulder, and I knew one of her wild shots had hit me. I managed to get to one knee, aiming the SIG fast at the blurred shape of the unwounded Nikolaides. I cursed my damn finger, which could barely pull the trigger, and saw that my left hand, supporting the barrel, was shaking like a mother. I squeezed off four, very fast, but all I could do was hit the old bull in the legs, knocking him to the ground, sending his pistol flying. I wheeled fast, knowing I had to finish it quickly, or I wouldn't have the strength. I saw the dickless Muscle Man lunging for his machine pistol. I shot on the turn, for the first time actually rising to the occasion, putting two in his chest, which was nothing fancy, but good enough to kill him. Nikolaides, bleeding, unarmed, saw Muscle Man crumple. Sprawled in the dirt, he looked up at me, hatred and confusion in his eyes. I guess he had thought it was going to be simple, an easy morning's work, but somehow I had survived waterboarding, turned my captors against him, and still shot well enough to put two of them down.
"Who the fuck are you?" he snarled.
I saw his eyes register his pistol lying almost within reach. I couldn't help remembering how he had smiled when he smashed my knee with his steel-toed boot, and the force of the hammer blows on my foot.
"They used to call me the Rider of the Blue," I said. "I was the person who ordered the killing of Christos and Santorini."
Nikolaides' face twisted. He was this close to revenge only to fail? He howled, and a massive burst of energy coursed through him like a death rattle. He hurled himself at the pistol. I fired twice, and at that range, his head pretty much exploded. I turned away. There wasn't any pleasure in taking a life, even that of a man like him. The day I felt there was, I knew it would be time to leave the battle forever. I leveled the SIG at Kamali. She was drenched in sweat, the adrenaline pumping so hard I don't think she really comprehended what had happened, and told her to remove the clip from the Beretta.
"Now, keep hold of the gun, point it at the ground, and fire three times," I said, making sure there wasn't a round still left in the chamber. "Now, drop the weapon," I said,
and once it was in the dirt, I told her to follow the same procedure with the two machine pistols and Nikolaides' pistol.
"Now, bring all the clips to me."
She picked them up, handed them over, and I put them in my pocket. With all the weapons separated from their ammunition, I pointed at the handcuffs, which were lying on the ground where she had dropped them, the key still in the lock.
"Cuff him," I said, indicating the Saracen.
He had dragged himself out of the rubble and was supporting himself by leaning against the water trough, deep in the canyons of despair, wondering why his god would have forsaken him at the final hour.
"Hands behind his back," I told her.
As she fitted the cuffs, I saw that hordes of flies were already settling on the corpses, and I knew it was nothing compared with the feeding frenzy when the intelligence services of half a dozen countries descended on him. He raised his lowered head and looked at me. I had the SIG in one hand, still trained on him, and with the other I was starting to rip strips off my shirt to combat bandage my shoulder and stop the bleeding. Our eyes met, and we both knew that whatever was left of his life, he would never get another chance to complete his volume of dark history.
"I love him," he said simply. He meant his son. "I know that," I replied. "It was the only weapon I had."
Kamali handed me the key to the cuffs, and I put it in my pocket with the ammunition. I pulled the bandage tight with my teeth, tied it off, and, with the pumping blood slowed to a trickle, I took Kamali's phone out of my pocket. The 3 minutes were almost up.
"Still there?"
I rasped.
"Christ,"
he replied.
"How many dead?"
He had heard the gunfire through the mic.
"3. It's over. You can let them go."
A moment later, he told me that the nanny was collapsing to her knees, and he had cut the little guy down. I turned and looked at the Saracen and his sister, and let them read it on my face. The woman and the child were safe. The Saracen, sitting in the dirt next to the trough, hands cuffed tight behind his back, bowed his head, and I knew he was praying. Kamali shuddered, surrendered herself to a tidal wave of relief, and started to cry. I was about to hang up. I knew I had to make another critical phone call, but the fever was coming on hard and my head was spinning. In the whirling confusion, there was something I had to know.
"Would you have shot the nanny?" I asked Ben.
He didn't reply, and I knew that was answer enough.
"Would you?"
he countered after a moment.
"That's the difference between us, Ben," I said softly. "It's why I was made for this business and you weren't." "Of course I would have."
Shaking, and not just from fever, I hung up and motioned Kamali over. I couldn't walk. God, I was so drained and hurt I could barely stand, and I needed her to lean on. She supported me under one arm, letting me take the weight off my mangled foot, and I turned to look at the Saracen.
"Try to come after me," I said, "and I'll shoot you both."
He nodded, and we looked at each other one last time. Both our lives changed forever. I remembered what a group of British soldiers had said after the Argentine War. It was only their enemies who knew what it was really like on the front line. I said nothing to him. What was there to say? And I motioned Kamali to start moving out, leaving him handcuffed in the dirt. The only key was in my pocket, the weapons rendered useless, and I knew for certain that there was only one way out of the ruins, by boat, and I was taking the only one of those with me. Confident he was trapped, I knew that probably less than 20 minutes after I made the next call, scores of men from dozens of different agencies would arrive. Not that they would have much to do other than arrest him. There was no plot to unravel, no network to roll up, no co-conspirators to track down. The soft kill of America was almost over. Hurrying now, I started to dial the second call, my fingers swollen and shaking, trying to remember the number I had been given, but which was stored on my smashed cell phone. Dragging one foot, helped by Kamali, I headed back down the crumbling passage, deeper into the gloom. There was one thing, however, that I had overlooked, and for the rest of my life I would wonder about the mistake I made. Chapter 43. Kamali led me through the barred gate, and as I stepped among the rocks, the dazzling sunlight hit me hard. The short distance from the water trough had been the most painful journey of my life, every step like one more blow. The waterboarding, the loss of blood, and the escalating fever were turning into a flood and taking a critical toll on whatever strength I had left. I felt the past and the present melding into one. I leaned against a boulder and ordered Kamali to get the cruiser from its hiding place and bring it up to the old jetty. As she headed off to a tiny cove behind a jumble of rocks, I hit the last digit of the number and heard the phone beep as it made the international connection. It was answered immediately.
My voice was barely audible.
Mr. President,
I said, as best I could.
Who is this?
A man replied, too young to be Grosvenor.
I need to speak.
I can barely hear you. Identify yourself, please.
He sounded like a Marine. I was weaker than I had ever thought possible, damaged beyond measure, but I knew what had happened. I was using Kamali's phone, and the White House communication system had identified the call as originating from a completely unknown source. Sure, I was phoning the president's direct line, but they weren't going to let a call like that go through until they knew who it was. Hence, I had been diverted to a high-security communication center buried deep in the Colorado Mountains, and I was speaking to one of the 1,800 Marines and technicians who manned it.
Identify yourself,
the Marine signalman repeated.
My name is Scott.
But I knew that was the wrong thing to say. A name would mean nothing. Standing in the pounding sun, my eyes aching, I felt myself drift from my body. As if from on high, I looked down on myself.
I can only just hear, the signalman said. Repeat, please.
I barely registered it. I was watching the old bull wield the stonemason's hammer, and I heard someone screaming in my head. I realized it was my own voice, but the only sound on the beach was the engine of the approaching boat and the scattered gulls circling overhead.
Pilgrim,
I managed to say. At least, I thought I said it, but I couldn't be sure. Maybe it was just in my mind.
I couldn't catch that. Repeat.
Silence. I was watching a little boy with Down syndrome run along the sand and jump into his father's arms.
Are you there? Say again, please.
The signalman's voice dragged me back.
I am Pilgrim,
I said. The signalman heard it. At the start of every shift for the past month, one order had been drummed into the heads of every Marine more than any other. If they heard a word, a certain code name, it had to be given priority over every other communication. The signalman was hearing it now.
Are you there? Please hold, sir. Please hold, Pilgrim.
He entered a series of rapid commands on his keyboard, calling up a list of officials who had to be told immediately. Pilgrim is live. Pilgrim is in contact. Pilgrim has come in from the cold. The first person on the list was the National Security Duty Officer, seated at his desk in a small office in the White House. It was very late, just after 4 a.m. on the East Coast, when he picked up his phone and heard an anonymous voice.
For the President, Pilgrim.
Even though the duty officer was certain the Commander-in-Chief would be asleep, his instructions were clear, and he immediately rang the phone in the President's bedroom. Grosvenor was a long way from sleep, though. More than 12 hours earlier, Whisper had called and told him about the hopeful message from Bradley. He was sitting in an armchair looking out at the lights of Washington, not seeing any of them, when the phone rang. He grabbed it, shocking the duty officer, who had expected a delay. Grosvenor listened as the man stumbled over the message.
What was that?
The president barked, anxiety getting the better of him.
It's Pilgrim,
the duty officer said at last. He heard Grosvenor murmur something that sounded like, Dear God, but he couldn't be sure. Why would the president be praying?
Are you there, Pilgrim?
I heard Grosvenor's unmistakable voice, even though the line sounded hollow and alien. Somewhere in my fractured mind, I understood that they were encrypting it in Colorado.
10,000 doses, I whispered.
10,000?
The president repeated in disbelief.
Already there, I said. He's using our own doctors. Probably starts in a few hours.
At some stage, after leaving the water trough, my training must have kicked in, and without realizing it, I had rehearsed what I needed to say. My throat was burning up, and I desperately wanted a drink, but the moment I thought of it, I forced the idea aside, frightened that the gag reflex would kick in. I tried to stay focused.
From Chiron,
I said, my voice fading.
Repeat that,
the president said.
It's a drug company. Karlsruhe. In Germany.
Another voice came on the line. It was Whisper, and I knew they must have patched him in, and he had been listening.
"Can you spell it?"
he said. I tried several times, but I couldn't get past the first few letters. My mind was struggling.
"Karlsruhe?" Dave said, trying to confirm it. I had never heard his voice so gentle, and I wondered why. I hoped he was okay.
"There's a hotel there, the Deutsche König,"
I managed to say, before my voice trailed off again.
"Great. That's great," Whispers said.
The president probably wondered if I was dying, but despite the stakes and urgency, he didn't try to force me on. I think he knew that somehow I was getting there.
"Keep going," was all he said. "You're a damned hero. Keep going."
"I should have asked for batch numbers," I rambled, weaker than ever. "I forgot things. This Harrison hurt me, you see. There was a child."
"Yes, we know," Whispers said.
"We shouldn't have done that. It was... I just didn't know any other way."
"Of course you didn't," Whisper replied. "It's over now."
From somewhere, I found a burst of energy, and it helped bring some clarity.
"It's a vaccine," I said. "It's in vaccine bottles."
"What vaccine?"
Whisper asked, still in that strange, gentle voice.
"Flu shots," I said. "He put it in flu shots. The season is here. Immunization starts tomorrow."
There was silence on the other end. I think they realized that I had done it. Two phone calls from the Hindu Kush had somehow led to doctors' offices throughout America. Then Whisper confirmed it, telling the president they had it all. The day, the manufacturer, and the method. I thought they were about to hang up. There must have been a million things to organize. But instead, Grosvenor spoke to me.
"Where are you?"
he asked. I didn't reply. It was done. And I was squinting at the sun, thinking about the long journey that lay ahead of me.
"He's on the coast," Whisper said. 19 miles north of Bodrum. Is that right?"
I still said nothing. I was gathering my strength, marshaling whatever resources I had left. I was going to have to crab my way across the sand to the old jetty.
"Can you hold on, Scott?"
Grosvenor asked, increasingly alarmed.
"I'm sending choppers from the Mediterranean fleet for you now. Can you hold on?"
"We'll have to tell the Turkish government," Whisper interrupted.
"Fuck the Turkish government,"
Grosvenor told him.
"No, don't. Don't send anybody," I said. "I won't be here."
Grosvenor started to contradict me, wanting to know what I meant, but Whisper stopped him.
"It's okay, Scott. I understand. It's okay."
"Damned if I do," Grosvenor said. "I'm telling you, the choppers are coming."
"He's injured, Mr. President. They hurt him."
It was time to go. And I suddenly started worrying that I had forgotten something.
"Did you hear?"
I told them.
10,000 doses. Chiron. Flu shots."
"Yes, we heard,"
the president replied gently.
"I want to say on behalf of the..."
I hung up. It was done. All of it was done. To endure. Wasn't that what I had said I had to do? To endure. Chapter 44. The tide had been surging higher, and, entirely by accident, it helped me. I limped and staggered across the sun-baked sand, heading for the wooden jetty, and had no choice but to pass through the encroaching water. When I was ankle-deep, the sudden coldness of it calmed the pain in both my foot and mind. I stood for a long minute, allowing it to cool the fever, and letting the salt sting and cleanse the open wounds. With a clearer mind, I reached the jetty, grabbed a handrail, and made my way to where Kamali was waiting. She had brought the little cruiser in stern first and had the motor idling. I hadn't told her, we hadn't talked about anything, but her journey was at an end. I was heading off alone, and I knew that what lay ahead of me was hard enough, especially in my condition, and I was anxious to start. That was when we heard the gunshot. We turned, looked at the theater of death, and I realized what I had overlooked, the mistake that I would wonder about for the rest of my life. Did I do it deliberately? Certainly, when I left the ruins, I was exhausted. I could barely walk, and I had to make the urgent call to Washington. Of course, I had taken every precaution by unloading the weapons and keeping the clips. But that was all in my conscious mind. In a far deeper place, did I know that there was another weapon? One that was fully loaded. My own Beretta, the gun which the Albanians had taken from me at the fall of masonry and discarded next to my smashed cell phone. Did I leave it there for the Saracen to use on himself? And if so, why? Obviously, he had remembered it, and the moment I heard the gunshot, I knew what he had done. With his hands cuffed behind his back, he had stumbled or crawled deeper into the passage and sat down next to the weapon. He had worked his hands down over his buttocks, picked up the pistol, maneuvered it between his thighs, lowered his face so that the barrel was almost in his mouth, and pulled the trigger. He probably knew the old song, too. When you're wounded and left on Afghanistan's plains, and the women come out to cut up what remains, just roll to your rifle and blow out your brains, and go to your God like a soldier. Kamali realized as soon as I did what the gunshot meant, and she started to run for the ruins. I grabbed her, but I was so weak she shrugged it off. It was only the urgency of my voice that made her stop.
"Listen," I yelled. "When they come, tell them that you knew nothing. Say that in the end you saved my life. Tell them about the man you shot. Say that you set me free, that you betrayed your brother. Tell them anything. I'm the only one who knows, and I won't be here."
She looked at me confused.
"Why are you doing it?" she demanded. "Why would you do this for a Muslim woman?"
"I'm not doing it for you," I replied. "I'm doing it for the boy. He deserves a mother."
I grabbed the roof of the boat's cabin and started to haul myself aboard. Kamali ran for the tunnel, but I knew it was a forlorn mission. Her brother was a Muj. He had brought down 3 Soviet Hind gunships. He wouldn't have missed. Chapter 45. Clutching the captain's chair, fighting the fever and pain, I edged the small craft away from the jetty and headed into open water. I swung south, hugging the shore, and ran with the throttle wide open, traveling fast. The wind had veered round, blowing hard against the tide, and the bow plowed through the steep swell, sending up sheets of spray and making the old engine howl. The journey might have finished me, but I forced myself to close the pain out and used my one good shoulder to keep the wheel on a course that was straight and true. Finally, I came round a headland, entered a long stretch of water sheltered from the wind, and felt confident enough to lash the wheel off and let the boat take care of itself. I went below and started to search. In a forward closet, I found an old backpack and used it to hold the SIG and the ammunition still in my pockets. Next to it, wrapped in a sail bag, I found a heavy, waterproof shroud already fitted with lead weights. There was no logic to it, but I was in a distressed state, and I didn't feel like traveling with my own burial sheet. I opened the window, threw it out, and watched it bob and sink in the foaming wake. Under a rear bench seat, I found what I was looking for, the vessel's first aid kit. It was probably 20 years old, but it had never been opened, and it was surprisingly well equipped. I took it back to the wheelhouse and used swabs to clean my smashed foot and a pair of scissors to remove the burnt flesh from where the bullet had entered my shoulder. I opened a bottle of antiseptic, 18 years past its use-by date, and poured it on the wounds. It still worked. Shit, did it work. I howled in pain and remained just conscious enough to be thankful that nobody could hear me. So it was, with my wounds bound with yellowing bandages, reeking of antiseptic, and equipped with a crutch adapted from an oar, that I finally saw the section of coast I was looking for. On the last breath of day, a long way south and a storm rolling in, I turned the wheel and passed between the clashing rocks that sheltered a secluded fishing village.
The first squall